everybody, and welcome to episode number 44 of Confessions of a Market Maker. I'm your co-host, Ray, a.k.a. All Day Ray, a.k.a. The Donkey Whisperer. And I'm joined here by my buoyant co-host, former market maker of 20 years and current day retail trader. What is his is yours, and what is yours, he's probably already had. Amen. Dubbed the corner because of all the traders he's turned inside out. I am talking about the proper villain, JJ.
How's it going? Hey, Ray. Good. How are you?
I'm doing good, man. Doing good. Our guest today had a legendary 15-year career on Wall Street. Our guest is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Buy Side. He's consulted on the hit Showtime series, Billions. He's been a journalist for CNBC, public speaker, and has ghostwritten for several projects. A man who's watched Sex and the City from the pilot to the series finale. I'm talking about Cleveland D, a.k.a. Turney Duff. Turney,
how's it going? How are you?
Oh, love that intro, man. I'm doing good. I appreciate you coming back on our first two-time guest.
Just for the record, though, having information, you know, having edge in 2002 at the bar, if you knew what happened to Carrie on Sex and the City last week, that actually worked to your advantage. So there was a reason why I was watching Sex and the City.
Oh, no, I'm all for it, Turney. Like, after we spoke in, I learned that was the reason why you're watching Sex and the City. I, like, immediately started to figure out, okay, what's the popular female show right now? Like, I'm going to get on it. But it's different nowadays. There's so many different streaming apps and services.
It's too much.
I just don't know if there's a consensus, you know? I couldn't figure it out. So, no, I always love that.
Have you watched Cobra Kai?
I haven't. That's on Netflix, right? It's new.
Yeah.
Pretty good?
I mean, if you like the movie Karate Kid, it's probably worth watching. Is it good? I don't know, but I don't know. It's like fast food, right? Like,
yeah, sure.
It tastes good going down, but it's not really good for you.
Right. Good stuff. Yeah, no, it's funny, Turney. I always, and I really believe in this point, and I try and tell people this, like, so, like, just the way how you approached just watching Sex and the City, but there was a reason behind it, right? It's like that we don't turn off that type of thinking. It's like that's how you see edges. It's a way of life. It's like the people think they could just turn it on when it comes to trading. It's like if you're sloppy in your regular life, you're probably sloppy when it comes to trading.
Yeah.
I just think it's a way of life. But anyway, Turney, since
to cut you off, you know, when young kids, you know, entering the workforce, like, are interviewing, and I tell them, I'm like, dude, I'm like, everyone says they read the Wall Street Journal. Everyone, like, knows that they're, I'm like, have something to talk about that is nothing to do with Wall Street or nothing to do with trading.
Yeah.
Like, have a personality and have some depth. That's who they want to sit next to for 12 hours a day. So it's like, be a person. You know?
Right. I mean, how much do you get a lot of people, Turney, that like newcomers or people looking for jobs on Wall Street, they come, they ask you for advice and stuff like that?
I did more like the first, let's say, few years after the book came out. And when I was very active at CNBC and blogging, I would get a lot of people reaching out to me. But like right before the pandemic, I was booked to speak to University of California, Long Beach was doing a weekend symposium for their business students and grads, business students. And so like the speaking engagements that I get sometimes are for people entering the workforce. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I speak to people. I would say that's probably my best demographic because I'm a B student from Ohio University and I found a way to kind of make it on Wall Street. And I also, you know, blazed quite a trail on how to fuck it up. So I'm a pretty good resource on how to get to the top and how to get to the bottom.
Yeah, for sure. I always like talking and asking different guests about the cultural, or at least perceived or what people think is like a cultural shift and kind of how what it was like during your day to what it is now. What's your take on that?
I mean, just the biggest difference, because I still have a lot of friends in the business and I, you know, from when I was working on Billions, you know, I've got my pulse on, you know, kind of the industry a little bit. it's much more sterile. I guess the easiest way to a lot of the fun has been sucked out, you know, which is good and bad, right? I mean, it's good for the business to be more efficient, and people are there to work, but you know, the play aspect was a lot of fun, as JJ can tell you, you know.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. You know, like I, with, and I don't know if this is a fair comparison, Turney, and I guess you could tell me, like, so what they show on Billions, for example, do you think there's, like, so you have, Bobby Axelrod versus Taylor, right? You have maybe like an old school, more of an old school approach versus like a new, you know, quant approach. Is that like something that's actually, you think causes division within like the industry nowadays?
I do, you know, it's very personal. Like people take things personal. My own experience on that, I left Galleon with the healthcare team and we started a hedge fund called Argus, right? And my former boss, or one of them, was this guy, Gary Rosenbach. He called every single sales trader on Wall Street that covered Galleon. And he said, if you talk to Turney, you can't cover Galleon. And at the time, Galleon was a $5 billion hedge fund. So it's like, are you going to go with, you know, a startup hedge fund or someone who's got $5 billion under management? Mm-hmm. And so he basically was trying to fuck me. What he didn't account for was I had to go out and make relationships at every other firm. And I still had those old Galleon relationships. And so, like, in a matter of months, I knew twice the amount of people on Wall Street. And it ended up being a great thing for me. But when people have an opportunity to screw an old nemesis, they'll do it. And I had instances where I would get shut out on a healthcare deal and it didn't make any sense. It would be like it was an overnight pricing. They're going to price like 2 million shares of MDRX, like maybe $1.50 in the hole. I put in for the whole deal. I get called back saying I was shut out. I talk about this in my book. And it turns out the Galleon like flexed their muscles and said, you better not give it any Argus. So that does happen. To the extent that they play it up on Billions, no, because you don't really know what the other person's doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I find it curious because I mean, you see it in, I guess probably all facets of life, all arenas is, you know, you have people who want to like, you know, do the way the things have always been done. And then you have like the new generation wants to come in and do it differently. And so I assume that's, you know, going on as well. So Turney, it's been a crazy year since the last time we spoke. What's it been like for you personally?
It's been okay. Because I have a 14-year-old daughter. And so when we first kind of went into lockdown, you know, I had some remote schooling stuff that I had to deal with more than normal. But my life hasn't changed that much. Other than I was in the process of pitching a TV show right as the shutdown happened, which that kind of blew everything up. But you know, it's just been kind of like a grind day to day. As far as the markets are concerned, like, you know, it's, I advised a few people and when it was time to buy, I told them only to buy like 25%. I just thought it was too risky. And so I missed a lot of the move up. And one thing which, and I don't know if this is true or not, but I read an article once that Wall Street loves, you know, 32 to 28-year-old males who are not married. And the reason is the less risk you have personally in your life, the kind of like the hardcore trader you are, right? I'm 50 years old. I have a daughter who's 3 years away from college. I'm not as risky as I used to be. But I've been following the markets a little bit. And I'm just, you know, one day at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it makes a lot of sense with the demographic, at least from a theoretical standpoint. I would think that would be true. All right, so
if you're 38 and just have a baby, do you really want to lose your job?
No, absolutely not. No, of course. Right. No, of course not. Yeah. If you don't, yeah, of course. It's you don't have nothing to lose. Let's go. Load it up. Right. Oh,
yeah. And what other business can you start a hedge fund, blow yourself up, and lose $1 billion, and then basically shut down for 9 months and then reopen?
Yeah, exactly.
What a business.
God damn, yeah. So just a reminder to the listeners, if you guys want to learn market auction theory, market profile, trade futures, trade equities, join JJ and I at the lovely trading community, microefutures.com. Attorney, when you see, you know, like an event like a pandemic, an anomaly, do you ever kind of like that old mind kicking, that old trader, like you miss the action sometimes, or is that, hey, that's in the
past? No, I mean, I definitely miss the action sometimes. I don't know if I have the wherewithal to be, you know, to doing it the day to day. But no, 100%. But I'm also reminded of, you know, how humbled I can be, right? So I couldn't have been more right in 2008, right? And if you read my book, like, you'll see, like, I nailed it. I literally nailed it. And guess what my fund was up in 2008? 10%, right? Mm-hmm. And I was hell-bent that I was still right in 2009. I didn't get carried out, but, like, it wasn't a great year. And you know, the market was pretty much going straight up since March. And so this time around, I wouldn't have been able to jump back in when I should have. You know, is this market is it's nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I
I'm sorry, this totally popped in my head. And maybe you can answer how you want. Dave, what's his name? Portnoy. Are you a buyer or a seller?
Of him?
Yeah.
My opinion on him, I think he's more of like a showman, right? That's my take.
I'm not a fan.
You're not a fan?
No.
I'm like him. I'm ambivalent.
Take a side. Be a trader. Take a side.
I think, okay, I'll say this. No. I guess I was trying to formulate how I wanted to say it. I think what is good, I think he is bringing in a lot of, like, new people into, like, okay, so me thinking as a trader, right? He's bringing in a lot of people into the market that have no idea what they're doing. So I think right. That's good. And everyone wants to come in and, like, attack him. It's like I made an analogy, right? Like, you don't tell the fish he's a fish at the poker table.
Right.
Let him keep doing that. Let him bring in some fresh new money into the market.
It's food. He's bringing in food.
That's my
opinion. I hear you. All right.
But I don't think he's as, like, dumb at, or – I think he's playing it up. Like, he's just being showman about it. That's my opinion. I don't know. What do you think, Jay?
All right. I like your answer.
I honestly love guys like this because what they are, they're like fishermen. They just keep bringing us food. You know? Because now I'm teaching retail traders how not to be food. But, you know, for me, before I was like, oh, dollar volume. When I look at a deal, I go, oh, it traded $300 million worth of paper. I could have been 30% of that and, you know, sold, you know, 30% into that volume and they wouldn't have even known I'm there.
Okay, right? Well, how about this, JJ? How do you feel about an app like Robinhood that will let, like, a 17-year-old over-leverage and then commit suicide?
I think... Man, that was a horrible story.
Messed up, right?
I've had, you know, my last friend who committed suicide was a market maker, and that was 2017.
Wow.
So I've had 12 buddies take their own lives in this.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, one of them, we were doing a short squeeze. The SEC halted the stock. He had everybody in it, put a gun to his head. So, you know, I've been through this, and it's just – No, this is the thing about this market, man. People, you know, it looks so easy. It's like shopping on Amazon, click, click, click. But there is a cost.
Right,
you know?
Right.
This market, it's, you know, and I don't mean to scare people away, but when you're putting money on the line and you're messing around and you don't know what you're doing, and they do let people play too much, you know, without knowing the risks. And in the old days, you know, when you called your broker to make a trade, he'd be like, you know, what are you, an idiot? Right? You don't have that checks and balances anymore.
Right. No, you're so right.
Well, you know, there's, you know.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right. Because I started off at Morgan Stanley PCS. So it was like, you know, high-end retail. And you're so right. Like, they sometimes would get talked out of things because it was just not smart. But going, like, sorry, like bringing this like in a sort of slightly different direction, but
no, that's cool.
So I've struggled with mental illness for a good portion of my adult life, and in the sweet spot, I was diagnosed with something called dysthymia, which is a low level, like low grade depression, and so nothing excited me. I lost the ability to get natural highs, and why that made me, you know, a good trader is because I could lose $1 million, is like, or I could make $1 million. I'd be like, and I was able to keep that even keel because of mental illness, you know, not because I had some superpower.
No, I feel horrible about that kid. Every person I think who's worked in our industry, especially when they've gone through hard times, they've all had that moment, you know, and it's that from Wall Street, and it sounded cheesy as hell in the 80s, but when you stare into the abyss and nothing stares back at you, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's, we've all had those moments.
You know? Yeah, no, it really, I can't even imagine being like 17, you know? Like,
yeah.
I wasn't even 32, and I was like, oh my God, if this stock doesn't correct, I've lost my job.
Yeah, I mean, when we were 17, you know, it was the 80s. It was carefree, you know. Right. We were, you know, thinking about girls and REO Speedwagon, right?
Totally.
Well, I think the discussion, I think it's a good point just to bring up. Like, I mean, if people, you know, listening, I'm assuming you want to trade, get into trading, you are trading. Just take the mental side of this game, like, really serious, because it isn't a joke. Like, this will toy with your emotions in both ways. And then, Tourney, I mean, we've talked about this plenty of times. Probably the worst thing for these, quote-unquote, Robinhood traders, these new traders, they won right away. I mean, the market, you can just close your eyes, go long. You've been making money these past few months, right? And so it creates that perception. They know what they're doing. Oh, it's easy. And, like, that's
totally
it's the worst thing for people.
So that's a great point. That's, like – that's just going to make it worse.
Yeah, it's just going to make it worse. Yeah. And so, you know,
I remember, so I have a buddy who, I should maybe get him to come on. He, financial planner, but he also is a professional blackjack counter.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wrote a book called, The Blackjack Life, Nathaniel Tilden. And, you know, I'm really good friends with him. I'm talking to him a lot. And literally as a, you know, blackjack counter, it's just discipline. If you can be disciplined, you can make money in doing it, right? And it's kind of like trading. If you're doing the right things and you're disciplined and you continue to, you know, work that discipline, you'll probably be successful. Absolutely. You definitely won't get, you know, carried out in a body bag. But it's kind of the same thing.
Absolutely. And shout out to one of our former podcast guests, Michael Noss, and he's like a big proponent of this. He's like, win rate doesn't matter, like, as far as like your trades go, right? Because if you're exercising good trade management, just win more on your winning trades than you lose on your losers. Right. You could be like a 25% winner and still be profitable, you know. It's not to simplify things, but that'll clean up a lot of your problems.
I don't know. I don't know if I shared this with you last time, but so when I was at Argus, I had $30 million just to play with on my own, right? And so I was killing it, like just knocking the cover off the ball. And my PM and the two head analysts pull me into a conference room. And they're like, look, they're like, you know, we want you to keep trading, but we want you to only trade names that aren't in the portfolio. And I was like, why? And they're like, because you're just picking winners. And I was like, isn't that a good skill set? Like,
isn't that,
I can look at our portfolio and say, yes, no. Like, so I was basically, you know, putting more money on our good bets and just killing it. Right. And they got pissed. Like, they're like, you're only picking the winners. I'm like, yeah.
No shit. Yeah. You know, Tourney, I wanted to ask you, because like this current climate we're in, and I'm not I don't talk politics on the podcast, and I'm like not going to today, but you know, just as an observation, this current administration, and I think probably others would concur, they seem very apt to want to pump the stock market right?
Oh, yeah, yes. It's fucking smoke and mirrors.
And as a hedge fund trader, I would imagine these guys like this. I mean, as someone who was a hedge fund guy, tell me, what's the perception?
I mean, to me, look, and again, I'll try not to make this political, but like, okay, so we had a good economy, right? Mm-hmm. Going into 2016, pretty, pretty good economy. And you're going to cut taxes, and then you're going to, you know, basically get your own way and lower rates, and you're going to deregulate everything, and you're cheering, right? It's like, no, like, you save it for a rainy day, right? Like, if you've got a strong economy, you don't need to be juicing it. And the thing that I get frustrated with is, like, people cheer, like, you know, oh, he got rid of regulations, right? I'm like, okay, well, smoking on an airplane, that's due to regulation, right? So blindly cheering getting rid of regulation is it's not smart. So, yeah, I'm a little nervous. I mean, it seems like it's puffed up. And this is the thing, though. Like, if you're currently in the market, you kind of have to stay in the market, right? Like, I would rather, you know, sell my portfolio down 5%. And then, you know, if there's a chance there's another 10 or 15, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. I'm okay being wrong for a couple of days. But the problem will be is if for some reason we gap down, you know, because we're in a civil war or something.
Yeah.
Wait, JJ. Don't say that. Don't say that. I'm in Canada, man.
Wait, is there any, if JJ, if you and I get married, can I be Canadian?
Man. I don't know why everyone's so angry down there. Everybody just needs to hug it out, right?
Yeah.
This is crazy.
We need something.
Yeah, man. All right. Well, you know, attorney, we want to bring you back on. You know, people love hearing, you know, how institutions, how hedge fund traders think, behave, you know, because as retail traders, you know, ourselves, we're at a sizable disadvantage, you know, in the market. So, you know, knowing how players that move markets think and behave is, you know, valuable to us. JJ, I know you got some questions for him.
Yeah, I mean, our room that we're teaching people, and I'm always telling them, you know, fund managers, they have, you know, like last year at Christmas time, the market kept going up higher and higher. And I'm like, well, you know, these fast money guys, they're moving it up. Their bonuses depend on, you know, what their numbers look like at the end of the year.
Right.
And they were like, really? You know, I'm like, yeah, you got to read the buy side, right? It tells you,
yeah.
Right? I know there's a lot of like, you know, salacious stuff in there, but he also tells you what's going on and how he's thinking and what he has to do to survive in the chair that he's sitting in, right? So, you know, that all of that, the motivations that create the agenda, that create the order flow, right? That's the whole thing I try and get across to people, and it's great that we have access to guys like you.
What's great for the people who are in your community is being in a community, right? Yeah. Like, that is it's so important to have people either to bounce stuff off of or mm-hmm. and I don't care who you are, like, you don't all have the same skill set, right? Exactly. So like, I need a guy who can read charts. I can't. It was, you know, 10th on my list of importance, but yeah. I wanted to know sometimes, right? Yeah. So, like, mm-hmm. I was able to use other people's skill set within my own hedge fund. But with your community, you build your own sort of, you know, people that you talk to every day. I think it's so important. And I don't know if we talked about this last time, but and I don't know if I mentioned it in the book. One of the things I used to do is I would take a little post-it note when I would go around and talk to my analysts, like on a quiet Friday, mm-hmm. and I would get their sort of unemotional, you know.
Yeah, input. I love it. That was in the book. Yeah, you put that in the book.
Yeah. So they would basically be like, oh, man, if Apple ever gets to this level, I'll back up the truck. Like,
yep.
You know, some 28-year-old is 180 pounds puffing out his chest. I was like, okay. And then 3 weeks later, you know, it hits that level. I'm like, what's up, dude? Are we buying 200 or 300? And you'd be like, whoa, I'm like, you, I'm like, has anything changed? He's like, no, but I'm like, then we're buying it. Like, yeah. You know, like, if you can take emotion out of it, you know, you still got to do your homework and check the boxes and make sure if something fundamentally has changed, don't buy it, you know. But if it's down because it's been a rough day in the market and it's a level that you have identified as wanting to own it. And this is the other thing. Sorry if I'm talking too much, but
no, this is perfect. Keep going.
But this is my attitude. Every single morning you walk in, all of those stocks in your portfolio, you are legitimately saying, I buy this stock at this level. You're every single morning, you know, even though it's sort of metaphorically, you are buying every stock that is in your portfolio because you're willing to own it at that price. So like where you bought it, you know, all these other like, well, I've only owned it for this, whatever it is. It's like, it's literally like buying it for the first time, I think, every single morning. And that's how you kind of should approach it.
No, that's perfect because I use that sticky note story all the time when markets sell off. They're like, well, why would they buy it here? Well, because this is an area that their analyst told them to. And that's the, you know, they've looked at the order flow around that area. They know that there's no blocks coming out to hit them in the head, you know, and, you know, they're going to stand in there. I'm like, Turney used to take a sticky note and put it on his monitor.
Right. Right.
Oh, okay. Right. So it's really wonderful to see how you guys.
Well, the other thing, do most of the people you guys are talking to, do they hold positions or is it like much faster? Is it like
mostly day trading, but there are okay. people who do swings. Yeah.
Cause I was just going to say, like, I used to see, you know, some people, you know, their favorite name would, let's say, get downgraded over Lehman's no longer, but, and the stock would be down 2 points. They would try to sell it, you know, because they thought it was going down 4 points, but I'm like, it's your favorite name. Yeah. You should be jumping up and down saying I get to buy more.
Yeah.
Right. You know, so it's like don't lose sight of what you're really trying to accomplish.
Right. No, I think that's a good point, Turney, because I think that even applies to day trading too. So even you just take that same concept and you put it on a smaller time frame, right? Because people will go in with a thesis, it starts going against them right away. They get shaky. Oh, boom, out. When you didn't let it develop. Actually, you got to talk about keep your emotions in check, stick to the plan, let it go. Go ahead, James. Yeah.
No, that's very true. So, you know, we always talk about, you know, you guys are the other time frame, the people who buy and hold for a while, you know, they initiate positions at certain levels and things like that. Now, we're always trying to tell people, you know, okay, this is initiative buying or this is just, you know, short covering, that sort of thing. So I just wanted to get into, talk a little bit about the healthcare mafia and how did you just naturally end up? Did you just, were these guys that you had gone to school with or past jobs or?
No, the healthcare mafia kind of, I guess, I mean, I was the ringleader, so I guess it developed because of me, but healthcare was that kind of industry where you better know the story, right? Like, it's not like trading IBM or, you know, Netflix or whatever, like, With healthcare, you kind of need to know the story. And so I started developing people, you know, relationships with people who knew what they were talking about. And the sell side was okay. But what I found was that it was the other buy side traders who really kind of knew, you know, the same thing that I did, but just different stocks. And so, and I teach my daughter this now, you know, we live in a favor economy, right? So,
yep.
What is the best way for me to get people to do me a favor is by me doing them a favor first. Right. So I talk about this in some of my speeches. I also believe in put getting fucked into the budget. Right. If you put getting fucked into the budget, that will allow you to operate freely, knowing that some people are going to screw you. Right. So I would go out and I would try to help other people and I would try to help them make money. The guys who just took all day, I stopped calling them. I stopped helping them, right?
Yeah.
But it was the guys who reciprocated and helped me that we all of a sudden started to build something, you know, that was worthy. And so it was just a matter. It took years, right? But over time, you know, I kind of had, you know, six, seven people who all were in the healthcare industry. we all kind of had our own little specialty. Like one guy could tell me, you know, what was going to be on the cover of Barron's the next day. And, you know, I knew another guy who like kind of had it in at the FDA and, and so just the tentacles kind of, you know, went far and wide. And then, you know, if we were up against, let's say, a Fidelity or a Wellington who just, you know, had a zillion, you know, shares to buy, we could be much quicker and collectively we could move a stock. Right. So there were times where we knew, you know, let's say Fidelity was choking on, let's say Express Scripts, ESRX, you know, a few of us would get in there on our machines and start, you know, kind of fucking with the price and just, you know, fucking make them sweat it out. And then they'd choke and then stock goes down and then we buy all we can. And, you know,
thank you.
Fun.
See, thank you. I'm telling these guys, this is what these guys do. Right. Those are just, you know, those are like, you know, business practices. Right. And it's good for people to understand.
I remember I was talking to the guys from Billions and we were working on a scene and they're like, well, what should he say here? And I said, oh, just, you know, buy it ugly. And they're like, what? I'm like, buy it ugly. And they're like, what does that mean? I'm like, you know, I just assume everyone knows what it means. But basically I'm telling the guy, get the stock as high as you can. I want a shitty execution price, you know, and I don't know. But, like, we would do that if we wanted to close at a certain price someday. So, there is manipulation going on all day, every day. So, sometimes when a stock moves some certain, you know, place and everyone around the street's going around, be like, why is, you know, XYZ trading here? Sometimes the answer really is, I don't know, no reason.
Yeah.
Because someone's doing something.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing is, I know this because when I used to take companies public, we'd always have a couple of fund managers and we'd sell them some of our illiquid stuff so they could mark it up at the end of the month if they had a bad month, right?
Right, right. Oh, yeah.
You know? And people are like, what? I'm like, I mean, you gotta have some window dressing, you know?
Yep. Well, I remember the end of 2008. I mean, I did this all the time and talked about it at the buy side, but we were long, I think it was 2008, but we were long something ridiculous, like, you know, something like 10 million shares of Blockbuster, like embarrassing now, you know, Netflix, but, you know, and it was like $3. So it really wasn't that big of a bet. But on the last day of the year, I was able to get it up $1. In the last 3 minutes, I made $10 million.
Yeah.
And it counted on our P&L for
Yeah, that's great. That's always.
I miss Blockbuster.
Well, because we see this because attorney JJ like points this out like you know like live like while we're trading and stuff and he'll like at the end of the month right Jay like you'll be like oh they're gonna mark this shit up you know watch boom
right
time and time again right. Because it's like you said, we're assuming they're just, you know, hey, just trying to make the books look good or whatever.
Right. Well, especially like, I don't know if it still happens like this, but like, I know hedge funds used to, sometimes it would be monthly, but usually it was a quarterly letter, right? And there are certain names you better have in the portfolio, like, because of whatever happened the last 3 months. And so there were times, like, sometimes we were buying stuff up at the end of the quarter just so we could, you know, tout the position in our quarterly letter, you know.
Right.
So.
Yeah, just and actually one thing that that people never really talk about. Now I'm not sure where you were when you were at Argus, you probably probably spoke to clients more than when you were at Galleon.
You mean investors?
Investors, yeah. You know, tell us a little bit about what investors in a hedge fund are like and what they're like to deal with so people kind of get a clue.
I mean, it runs the gamut, right? It's interesting because, like, sometimes, you know, like some 28-year-old would walk in and it was like low man on the totem pole was in charge for, you know, allocating money. Like, and then other times it was, you know, a 60-year-old crusty white dude. But... you know, it was kind of a dog and pony show and like, oh, here's Turney, our head trader and whatnot. But like many things, I kind of felt like 95% of them didn't really know shit. You know what I mean? Like, they just had access to a lot of money. And it's constantly changing. So I was, for the majority of my career, I was at a sectorized hedge fund, a $1 billion hedge fund. But, you know, there was a time where people wanted, you know, all these guys only focus on healthcare. I want to, you know, let's give them 50 million and then, you know, we'll spread it around across the street. And then it kind of shifted to why do that? Why I'd rather just be at, you know, some macro, you know, hedge fund. And so that's constantly changing what they want and kind of like how you, I don't know. Am I getting off track?
No. I wanted people, because I always get people who want to trade prop, who want to, you know, they're young guys and girls who want, you know, to be in this business. So they should kind of get an idea of what it's like dealing with OPM, other people's money.
Right.
You know,
you down with OPM?
You know, attorney, you know, dealing with people who, like you said, 95% of the time they really don't know what's going on, right? They're just giving you guys money. I could assume like maybe sometimes that could cause problems. Maybe they're impatient. Maybe it's like they're not given time for the...
1,000%.
Yeah, right.
And typically, like just the way the world works is usually it's that smaller client who's anal who causes you 10 times the work as... You know, the guy who's got 100 million with you. But yeah, that's actually a skill set, dealing with, you know, your investors, right? And the idea is to get to a certain point where you can turn down money, right? Yeah. Where you can say, I don't need your money. And this is, if I'm repeating myself, I apologize, but like, I know this is retail investor, so it's not the exact same thing, but one of the best things you can do, let's say as a sales trader, is turn down trades, right? And like I tell the story where this guy from Merrill Lynch, I call him up, I said, hey man, I need to buy a million Biogen. And he's like, all right, hold on, I'll call you back. And he calls me back, he's whispering, he's like, hey man, he's like, my biotech trader's out today and the backup sucks. He's like, go away. He hangs up. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, at the time, I was paying 6 cents a share. And I'm like, he just literally turned down $60,000.
Exactly.
Like, that's my guy.
Yeah.
Like, I trust him more than I trust anyone on the street. Yeah. And so when you look out for someone, like that will last for years.
Yeah, I found that too. Especially I'd be sitting at a deal table and, you know, the guy's, you know, ready to write a check for $5 million. And I'm, you know, he looks at me and I kind of like, wince, you know. And right. Those guys have always become the best clients later on.
Totally.
You know? It's like, you saved me that five sticks. Oh wow, thanks, you know. It's so
it just shows. And even if you're doing it as a con, like, it still works, right? But like, if I think that you're looking out for my best interests, that's all I need to know.
Got to ask, in your dealings, now I know you've seen the episode of Billions with Fraudy Anisman. Did you ever have to deal with a guy like that?
not quite like that.
Was that the real sloppy guy that, okay, yeah, when they had to go to him for money, right?
Yeah. Okay. Because, okay. Yeah, Vancouver was full of guys like that.
Well, it's, you know, I mean, it was a different era, but, you know, like when I was at Galleon and even when I was at Argus, it was like, we could be picky.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So didn't have to deal with too much bullshit, you know?
Speaking of Galleon, now Raj is Sri Lankan. I'm Sri Lankan, right? So what was he like to work for? Like, I know you read it in the book. Can you talk about it, or is it?
Yeah, I can totally talk about it. Yeah. He was a giggler, you know, like, and then the way I described it was, you know, when he would walk in, it was like the homecoming queen and people were dropping, you know, rose petals in front of his feet. He was so sinister that he would smile and laugh at you right before, you know, slitting your throat, you know, like he was so charming and so like, you know, nice. And then he would just stab you in the eye. So, but yeah, he was slick. Let me just put it that way. Very slick.
I always wondered because, you know, there's not many Sri Lankan fund managers around. So they were always curious.
This is the thing though. Like if he didn't cheat so egregiously, yeah, he still would have been one of the best.
He was. Yeah, he was sharp.
Yeah. He would have been one of the best. He didn't need to cheat.
He didn't need to. Yeah. Wow. He recently got released, correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. How long did he do? What, he did like a decade or so?
So ironically, he was sentenced. This is kind of not a funny story, but I went down to Occupy Wall Street in like, I don't know, maybe October of 2011. And I went down there and I kind of wore disguise because I was afraid like Wall Street people would see me. Because I wasn't going there to be part of it. I was going to like check it out and see what, and I had written like half of my memoir at that point. And I'm sitting there and I'm at Occupy Wall Street in disguise. And I get a text on my BlackBerry because I hadn't gone to iPhone yet. And it says, Raj Rajaratnam sentenced to the largest sentencing in the history of Wall Street. And I'm looking at Occupy Wall Street and I'm looking at this text. And Paradigm, who was my first agent, like told me that I had to finish the book in order to sell it. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at this text, I'm looking at these people marching. And I'm like, if today is not the best day to sell my book, like when, you know, so I got in a cab, went home, called Paradigm, said, I'm done, called this other woman and said, I want to go with you. And 2 weeks later, I'd sold my book. And the day my book was announced was the day that he actually had to show up.
Oh, wow.
To prison. So he went in like the first week of December of 11. And I believe he got out maybe in 18.
Yeah.
He's read your book, you think?
I have no idea.
I bet you he has. I bet you he has.
I mean, what else is he going to do, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
Although, from what I heard, I know one guy who would go up to visit him a lot. And I heard he had quite the setup, like, you know, like Goodfellas type of.
Yeah. Well, that's what comes with the money, right?
Yeah, I think he had a really good setup.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Like, he might even have a butler. I'm serious.
That's nuts.
And
that's nuts. Turney, how long did the book take you from start to finish?
Yeah.
It actually took me, I would say, about 9 months. And that's, you know, working pretty much every day. I had to write. I wrote a shitty novel in the summer of 2010. And so I don't think if I hadn't written that novel first, I wouldn't have been able to write The Buy Side at the level that I did. So I had to write a book in order to write a book. If that makes sense.
Yep.
But yeah, it was about 9 months. It was completely my job. I did it every single day and I loved it. I loved every minute of it.
Yeah. Well, it came out phenomenal. And like Jay was saying, what I think is so good about your book, like what he's saying is like, okay, he tells people read The Buy Side. You'll understand more what hedge funds, large institutions, but with that, it's funny too. We get your life. So I love like both angles of it. Yeah, man, it was a great, real, real enjoyable story. Jay, you still got some more questions or should I?
No, just one.
Yeah.
You know, I'll let you go, but have you ever, because we used to do this all the time, you know, when did you guys ever do pipes and convertibles on companies and did you short the stock down before?
A little bit. I had a buddy who, his name was Scott Cohen and he didn't invent pipes, but he was like the guy.
Okay.
And so, he structured a lot of those deals, but I could only do healthcare. So it was, okay, you know, far and few between, but, Yeah, I would definitely do some of that. But I actually have a question for you guys. So what is oh, my God, now I'm drawing a blank. It's almost like circumventing IPOs. It begins with an S. S-P-A-C or
– Oh, S-P-A-C. Those, yeah, those S-P-A-Q things.
What,
yeah.
What's going on with those? I haven't do you know, man, or no?
They're basically like a fully funded shell, right? You get a bunch of investors – right now it's big money, right?
And they, I was gonna say, vehicle. But it seems like really easy to scam, or no?
Well, no. These, because now they've got, like, you know, the big boys, you know, like fund managers now have one, right?
Okay.
It's
okay.
Like, it's like wanting to do your own deal, but it like in my deal, like I've done like 200 reverse mergers. Take a OTC shell or a NASDAQ shell and put a, you know, RTO, a company into it.
Okay.
So that's pretty much what they're doing.
Gotcha.
Just on a on a big scale.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was going to tell you the margin call story.
Oh, yeah, the margin call story.
So it's 2010. I just got out of my second rehab, and I'm living in this 6,000-square-foot house. It's going into foreclosure, half-furnished because my girlfriend's gone, my daughter's gone, the pets are gone, and I got really no access to money. And so a friend of a friend calls me up and is like, hey, you know, this movie production is looking for a set for a big house. I was like, oh, perfect. I'm like, have them come to my house. And so they show up and they're like kind of doing a location scout, and I'm going through and I'm giving them the tour. And by the end of it, they kind of know my whole life story. And so at the end, the woman was like, look, she's like, I don't think your house is right for a movie, but I have a friend who's doing this movie called Margin Call and doing, you know, working on props, and you know, would you mind talking to her? I was like, yeah, no problem, whatever. So I call her up, and we kind of go back and forth, and I'm telling her every single thing that she needs for a trading desk scene. And so, and then at the end, I said, look, I said, there's one thing that is really, really, really important. She's like, what's that? I'm like, you have to have hot sauce on the trading desk. I'm like, literally every third desk needs hot sauce. She's like, why? I'm like, we put that shit on everything. I'm like, it has to be there. And so if you watch the movie Margin Call, and any scene that has a trading scene, you can find a bottle of hot sauce. And then my favorite moment of the whole movie, right about the midpoint, one of the younger analysts comes back with breakfast.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, the head guy's like, hey. He's like, oh, yeah. And he reaches. Yeah. He throws him some hot sauce. I'm like, that's all because of me.
Yeah,
that's great. Is the one you just showed on camera, the Cholula, is that your go-to hot sauce?
Yes. Oh, yes. It's everything.
I
have a question. What do you like better, Margin Call or Big Short?
I'd have to say Big Short. Margin Call was okay. I don't know. Demi Moore as a risk management officer, just, you know,
I hear you, but they're both great. They're both great.
They're both good movies. The best thing is when the guy calls up Deutsche and he goes, Will Emerson. He goes, fuck off, you limey prick. Click. That was like one of the most accurate things.
Totally.
Fuck off, JJ. Click.
They did a great job in them.
Yeah.
All right. So what I've been doing lately on the podcast, Tony, I've been doing some like rapid fire / miscellaneous questions to get into. Jay, anything else for Tony before I jump into this?
No. Groove with it.
Speed round.
All right, here we go. Favorite Billions set moment, or just Billions moment in general?
Fake fight. Dollar Bill and Axe, fake fight.
Yeah, how was that? You were there for the scene?
Yeah.
How was it?
Yeah.
Well, tell me about it.
It's phenomenal. It was,
yeah,
I mean, it was just, you know, I worked with the writer who wrote that episode, and I was like, yeah, if you have a fake fight that will spread on Wall Street like that, then Dollar Bill can turn around and tell those people who left, you mm-hmm. know, some inside information that's wrong, and get them back. Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to Dollar Bill. We had him on. Great guy. Yeah. He cracked his rib. Yeah.
Yeah. Boxing. Yeah. He's a great guy. And Daniel, who you had on.
Yeah, shout out to both of them. Yeah, shout out to both of them. They were both really nice, open guys, and that's what I get a vibe. Like you were saying beforehand, before we started, just different vibe they have there.
Yeah,
Okay, as a Cleveland sports fan, there's been some rumors circulating about Odell Beckham Jr. Any thoughts?
And?
Okay, I guess we'll move
on. Where's the question?
No, any thoughts on these alleged rumors?
I mean, look, dude, we're all into, like, different things. So, like, don't judge.
Right.
You know, I mean, this isn't a fast answer, but when I was writing my book, there was a scene where I was with this this escort, right? And so I called my friend Brian up, and I was like, hey, can you read this chapter? He's like, yeah, whatever. And he goes, well, where did you find her? And I was like, well, I was on this website called Eros, and I searched mature. And he goes, you have to put that in there. And I was like, hell no. I'm like, I don't want people knowing that. And he's like, you have to. And so, like, I got the courage, and I put it in there. And at that point, I realized, like, when you're writing a book, like, if you're honest, it'll show through. So, not that I'm into people shitting on me, like OBJ. No, I don't. I think it's total bullshit. I highly doubt it.
Yeah, I highly doubt it as well. It's so funny, right? Just him playing for the Browns. It's just
Cleveland Seamer.
Yeah, it set up for a lot of funny jokes. Yeah, it's a funny moment. All right, while we're on the Browns topic, over under on their win total this year, 8.5.
Oh, over. They're gonna win 10.
Yeah, you think so?
Yeah,
I like them for a bounce back year. I think a very talented roster. Offensive line's improved.
They improved the offensive line.
Yeah,
they've got two of the best running backs, Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt.
Yeah.
If they protect Baker Mayfield, they're gonna be tough to beat.
I mean, it's really like the whole roster, really talent up and down.
We had a first year coach last year, which just running the right game plan for the players he had. So
yeah, I think we'll see this year. I was reading some, you know, we were talking about even before the podcast too, as far as like analytics and things of that. I'm real into that. Right. As far as football wise. Talking about with Baker excels off the play action. I think most quarterbacks actually do off the play action. And so there's a lot of speculation. That's what the Browns are going to get back more to because the coaches are more. And
especially if Chubb is ripping 8, 9, 10 yards a carry, play action works even better.
Oh, of course. Of course. Do you, you don't strike me as this, but do you venture into any gambling, sports, casino, things like that?
I did. And it was getting close to my love of cocaine and alcohol.
Yeah, sure.
So I kind of just – I pulled back.
Yeah. Makes sense. Books you're currently reading?
I just finished it's a book called Sway. It comes out – it came out Tuesday, but I just finished it. It is the first book written by a child of a 9/11 – survivor. So he was 9 years old when his father died, Cantor Fitzgerald. And then he ended up having some struggles with addiction, some family abuse, like really pretty fucked up story. He spent his entire life trying to figure out, did his dad jump? Did his dad die in the fire? Literally just finished that book, Sway. S-W-A-Y. Wow. It's great.
Yeah, sounds like it. Wow, Sway. Okay. All right, Turney. Who was someone who complimented you on your book or writing that you were like really taken back by?
It was pretty cool to get a blurb from James Patterson because I didn't really know it was coming. When I found out that James Patterson read my book and liked it and blurbed it, it was pretty like, oh my God.
Yeah, I bet. Wow, that's dope.
Actually, this is another one which – I don't know for sure, but about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, randomly one day, I got a notification on Twitter that Ryan Reynolds followed me. And I was like, that's weird. And so I was like, I better follow him back, right? So I'm guessing maybe he read my book. Like, why else would he follow me?
That's cool.
A bouncer in a nightclub that used to go to all the time in Vancouver. He's a nice kid.
Who, Ryan?
Yeah.
Oh, he seems great. Seems very great.
Nice.
Yeah. Funny guy. So he used to go to the club, Jay, that you used to bounce at?
Yeah. All the time.
Wow. Didn't you say De Niro came through one time, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was an interesting place, right? Vancouver had a lot of of those Hollywood types.
Yeah,
it makes sense, right? Yeah. Is Seth Rogen from Vancouver?
I think he is.
Yeah, he's definitely Canadian. Yeah, I've really been pushing him, Turney, to he's writing a book of his own. He's got some interesting stories as well. So I'm pushing this man from his days as a bouncer.
I gotta finish it.
Yeah, you can call it the sell side.
Attorney, any projects you're working on that you can speak to?
I kind of in 2018 made more of a switch or an effort to do film and television. So in the beginning of quarantine, I was hired to write a adaptation of a documentary that was in Sundance called The Mole, and it was about an 82-year-old who was hired to be a private investigator at a retirement home to investigate the alleged abuse and neglect of one of their patients. So I just handed that in, and they're looking for a director. I had a TV show that we were pitching called Across the Aisle, which was basically a black public school teacher and a woman, a data scientist on Wall Street. Her name is Lenny. She's named after Lenny Dykstra. Her dad's a cop and NYPD. They ended up getting, having a whirlwind date in 2016. They have sex. She goes to the bathroom and he's naked lying on the couch, realizes he's sitting on something, puts his hand in the couch cushion and pulls out a red hat that says Make America Great Again. And so she comes out of the bathroom and he's like, what's this? She's like, my hat. It's like, you bought it? And she's like, yeah. I'm like, with money? So he had this huge epic fight. And at the end of the pile, it turns out she's pregnant. So it's about a Trump supporter and a very liberal guy having to co-parent. Oh. So haven't sold that yet, though. And then I'm working on a new show right now that we're getting ready to pitch.
Excellent. Exciting. Do you, for projects you think of or writing or TV, whatever you're getting into, do you try and keep a Wall Street or like some tie into Wall Street, or are you trying to kind of get away from that now that this is like, you kind of in a new career, et cetera?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I try to get away from it, but I'm not like, I'm also not trying to make it my sole focus, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But like, I'll try to find something about me in almost all the characters that I write, so yeah. It's just easier to kind of get it out there, when I know the characters better.
Yeah, sure. And I think that probably comes across better that way, I would imagine, as well, too.
Yeah,
it's more personal.
About it.
Right, absolutely. All right, and that's it. That's the rapid fire right there. Yeah, so
thank you for having me.
Absolutely. That's going to conclude today's episode of Confessions of a Market Maker. If you guys enjoyed the show, please rate and review it for us. If you guys want to learn market auction theory, market profile, trade futures, trade equities, join JJ and I at microefutures.com. Turney, tell the people where they can find you. Anything else you want them to know?
Turneyduff.com if they want to look for more. I'm on Twitter, Facebook, you name it. And that's pretty much it.
JJ, parting words.
Great having you back on the show, brother.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. And I like the, you're starting to look like Papa Hemingway there with the beard. You're settling right into it. It's beautiful.
You know what, though? I got to tell you. So everyone's kind of growing a Corona beard. I've been shaving 2 or 3 times a week. So my normal look is like much more scruffier than this. And so like, I love being Contra. And so like, I've started to shave twice a week, which is a lot for me. I'm due for one though.
It seems like a lot of Contra. It seems like a lot of good traders are that way.
Definitely.
I think so.
Yeah. Attorney, I forgot to ask you that, like during this whole pandemic, and I guess kind of now that we're, I don't know if we're easing out of it or not, but how is it in New York? What's it, how's the climate right now?
It's hard to find someone without a mask, which is great.
Yeah.
People are following the rules. I think we're down to like something like 0.6%. So the numbers are really solid. We had a really rough start. But I would say we're in good shape. The problem is, at least from my view, we're not out of the woods probably until next spring, right? So if you take your foot off the gas,
yeah,
it can get ugly quick. So we'll see.
Yeah. I guess any thought, like, you know, I don't know, as being a speculator, you know, a trader, I always like to think about future events. I mean, like, just the societal impact this could have. I mean, any like thoughts to that, like, how long, you know, people could be wearing masks for a long time. I don't know, maybe social distance. I don't know. Like, how do you, any idea, or it's, no one really knows.
Yeah, no, it's tough. Like the initial trades probably, you know, happened a long time ago. I think we need more dust to settle to kind of see, but there will 100% be some cultural shifts that we're not even kind of like thinking about right now. So I think the next 6 months, keep your eyes and ears open. And if you're noticing something different in your own personal life, you might be able to find a trade.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's probably not a day trade. It's probably something,
right.
You know, and even if it's 550 shares and forget about it, you know, like you're allowed to do that.
Absolutely. Good stuff. Good stuff, Tourney. Thanks again. Listeners, go out. If you have not read his book, go out and get it. It's phenomenal all around. If you want to learn more about institutions, if you want just a great read, a great memoir, go pick it up. So for Cleveland D, I'm Paulie Walnuts. He's the Gorilla of House Street. You stop something.